SodexoUSA.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. One woman was forced to flee Baghdad when Ba'athists wanted her father. One woman watched as tanks destroyed her house in northern Iraq. And one, until the U.S. invasion, had known nothing but life under the rule of Saddam Hussein. Now all three are working to rebuild their lives, their status as women, and their country. In this hour, we'll hear their stories. Tonight on Point, three women of Iraq and their vision for the country and its women. But first, we begin in Washington, where the Pentagon today announced plans to call up 47,000 more Reserve and National Guard troops for Iraq and to alert another 85,000 active duty troops that they will soon be headed out as well. The fresh troops will be sent to Iraq as part of a force rotation plan. Earlier, I spoke with John Diamond, Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. I asked him if the rotation will ultimately lead the number of troops in Iraq up or down.
For a period early next year, there will be a bulge or bubble in the number of forces, jumping up by perhaps as much as 45,000 to 50,000 over the current 132,000. That will be temporary because of an overlap of troops as new troops rotate in and others rotate out. But the overlap is deliberate to have a particularly large force in place at a time when the United States is hoping to be shifting to a fairly sizable or much larger Iraqi police and military force. After that, the total numbers by next May, if all goes as planned, and even the Pentagon says that's a big if, will drop from the current 132,000 down to about 102,000.
John, what portion of the new troops going over to Iraq will be National Guard and Reserve? What portion will be active duty troops?
Yeah, another very important point. The percentage of troops that are made up of Guard and Reserve is going to increase pretty sharply from currently about 22% to 38% under this new plan. So it'll go from about 1 in 5 to 2 in 5. And these are folks, of course, who for the most part are being pulled out of private sector walks of life and thrust into a situation where they could be gone for a year to 18 months.
And what kind of roles will they be playing?
A wide range. The military relies on these people to do various specialty roles that include civil affairs and communications and a whole variety of logistical and transportation, aerial refueling, all sorts of specialty jobs that are in high demand in this Iraq deployment. Another significant element to this whole thing is the Marines will be sending 21,000 in two successive groups of 7 months each. And this is going to be the first time since Vietnam that a large force of Marines has been deployed for a long period for combat duty. Marines are typically what they call expeditionary. They go out and respond to crises, and then they pack back up and get on board ships fairly quickly. So this is going to be a seven-month deployment for one group of 21,000, followed by another 7 months by a second group.
From everything we see, this has been a difficult rotation for the Pentagon to plan. Why so hard?
The demand has been tremendously high. Even though the military is a total of 1.5 million in the active duty, and the deployment in Iraq is 132,000, when you narrow it down to frontline combat troops and especially Army frontline combat troops, a very large percentage of the force is tied up in this mission, putting a strain on the entire military. And it's just been very difficult to manage. The demand for specialty jobs, the need to tap into the reserves who just aren't really set up for continuing long deployments without causing a great strain. This is all a big problem. In addition to that, you have the issue of retention. In other words, how many people sign up for another tour. And the Pentagon today, Secretary Rumsfeld, made it clear that he's worried about those numbers increasing, and they're going to be watching that very closely.
So when all of this is accomplished, is the U.S. military at a kind of maximum stretch here? Is it Is it as fully deployed as it can be?
It's getting close to that. This is a dramatically smaller military than it was at the time of the Persian Gulf War in 1991. It's gone from about 2 million down to 1.5 million. There were 500,000 troops that went through the Gulf that earlier time. It is stretched pretty thin. It would be hard to significantly ramp up the presence in Iraq without really pulling out, having to pull out of other places such as, say, Korea or Bosnia. There is, in fact, a plan for a troop reduction in Bosnia, and they've talked about possibly changing their footprint in South Korea, so we'll see about that.
General Peter Pace said today that they hope to have 170,000 Iraqi troops up and trained and ready to serve by next May. All of this seems to depend on that happening, doesn't it?
Yes, it's the so-called Iraqification of this conflict, and it is going to be a major undertaking that requires a tremendous amount of training and also vetting to ensure that you're not putting Iraqis into the field on behalf of the coalition who are, in fact, helping out the other side. This is a major worry right now.
If those troops aren't ready, for whatever reason, is there a chance that the U.S. troops would stay on longer, that the U.S. troop number would stay high rather than decrease?
You could see extended deployments. The Pentagon, Secretary Rumsfeld, was very careful today to leave open the possibility that more troops would be put in if needed, that they weren't ruling it out, and that it really depended on the security situation on the ground improving. And right now, the troops there for the coalition have not found the formula to make that happen yet.
And, John, if Secretary Rumsfeld is concerned about troops dropping out of the armed forces, a low percentage re-upping, are there extraordinary plans for expansion to sustain troops available, even any talk of a draft?
The Bush administration has not proposed expanding the size of the military. The costs involved are enormous and would require probably cutting into some of the technology and weaponry programs, such as the F-22 fighter and so forth. It would be a major policy change to reverse that, although it has been discussed. Nothing's been proposed. As for the draft, the administration, especially Secretary Rumsfeld, has essentially said that with today's military, with the specialty jobs, with the high level of training required, with the need for high motivation and morale, which you tend to get in a volunteer force and which you tend not to get in a draft force, that they're disinclined to go back to the draft. There are some folks who do talk about that as being a way to get the citizenry more involved in the military than it is now, where the military is sort of almost a segregated society unto itself, apart from the general populace.
Not entirely segregated. 47,000 National Guard and Reserve with a big heads up today to get ready to ship out for as long as 18 months.
That's right.
It's a long deployment. John Diamond, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He spoke with us from Washington. In post-war Afghanistan, women were the symbol of liberation for a country freed of the fundamentalist rule of the Taliban. In Iraq, the status of women is more complicated. Freedoms have come and gone. The fall of Saddam Hussein brought liberation, but also fear in the mean streets of a country still in turmoil, and deep uncertainty about what lies ahead. Tonight on Point, Iraqi women, their stories, their struggles, and their hopes now. Have you noticed how Iraqi women seem to be missing from so many street scenes we see from Iraq? What do you want to hear from women who have seen tyranny and reconstruction efforts firsthand? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by three Iraqi women helping lead their country forward in a tumultuous time, and I'm so glad to have all three of you here. Ala Talabani is an Iraqi Kurd and co-founder of the Iraqi Women's High Council, a group established this October to draft policies on the role of women in Iraq's reconstruction. Good evening and welcome, Ala Talabani.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Lina Aboud is a Baghdad-based physician and founder of Awakening Iraqi Women, a post-Saddam-era group promoting the role of women in Iraqi life. She has spent her entire life in Iraq and left there for the first time only a few weeks ago. Good evening and welcome, Lina Aboud.
welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And with us, Hind Makia, born and raised in Baghdad, now a UK-based Iraqi exile. She is the co-founder of the Iraqi Women's Foundation. Hind Makia, very good to have you here tonight.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Gosh, there's so much we want to ask you, and I guess the first thing to be said is that whether you've lived there throughout, or you've been in, as you have, Lina Abboud,
yeah,
or you've been in and out, as you have, Ala Talabani, or
yeah,
you've been away for some time, all of you have in recent months been in Iraq and seen exactly what's been going on there. I wish that we could, you'd be good enough to kind of jump in with some illustrations. We've got a big story to tell here about what's happened over time, but what incidents or moments to each of you kind of capsulize the challenge or the moment for Iraqi women right now? Lina Abboud, if I may turn to you first,
yeah,
what have you seen in recent weeks, in recent months, in the lives of Iraqi women that will help Americans understand,
yeah,
what those women are now facing?
Yeah. First of all, we are feeling more freedom than before Saddam fall.
Mm-hmm.
And we are now facing problems and dealing with the new democratic process and with the rebuilding, reconstruction of Iraq to find a real role for Iraqi women in the whole of this process. And the real major problems we are facing that to put her to be in the higher position, in the positions of decision maker, to get a real role in the Constitutional Council.
But in the everyday life, we'll look
yeah
at that, but in the everyday life
everyday
of Iraq
life,
right now, do you feel
yeah
free to be on the street, to be going to the to shopping, to be going to restaurants? Is that open to you now?
Yeah, it's open, but it's some sort of limited. Because, you know, of all being increasing of military operations against all the Iraqi civilians, and you being get bombed in any moment if you are going to your job or if you are shopping or you are, any moment.
Which can't be an easy situation.
Yeah.
Ala Talabani,
yeah,
in the newspaper photographs we see, in the TV footage that we see, I have to say men seem to absolutely predominate the street scenes. Is that just what American reporters happen to be shooting? Or are Iraqi women kind of staying out of the public arena to some degree right now?
I will tell you that Iraqi women are participating now in reconstruction of Iraq. But you are right. I mean, I am seeing in the medias as well that they are showing men more than women, but that doesn't mean that women are not out. Yes, I will tell you, in Baghdad and some small towns around Baghdad, which we have the more problems, women are a bit afraid to go out. But that doesn't mean they are not coming out. I mean, they already gathered to hold lots of conferences, meeting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They started establishing NGOs. They really participating in create that civil society and be part of the democracy life, which they've been through for the first time in their life.
So is this an optimistic moment for you, Ala Talabani?
Yes.
And Hind Makia, you've been back for several months recently, working at a number of levels with all of the interim arrangements that are going on in Iraq right now. Give us an anecdote, an illustration of how you see Iraqi women's situation right now.
I'll give you two anecdotes. One anecdote for me was a meeting with the members of the Baghdad Council, the Women's Committee of the Baghdad Council, where we were sitting together to look at the development of a Baghdad Women Foundation linked to the Baghdad Council, but independent, politically independent of it, to set up women learning centres.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting discussing what our aims and mission statement would be. And we were totally engrossed, and imagine a total engrossment in writing and thinking about what our vision is. And as one, the vice president of Baghdad Council, who's a member of this NGO, turned round to me and said, I will never forget this moment where we are free to talk, and we're talking about the creating the environments for debate and discussion.
Savoring that moment, the sensation of possibility.
She said she would savor it for years to come, because she said she's never had that opportunity to have that discussion. And another image that comes to my mind is of a great woman activist in Alamiya, which is a fairly poverty-stricken area of Baghdad,
mm-hmm,
needing to go and fearful and needing to go to in some form of transport to other female activists to bring them on board in the neighbourhood and district levels, and having to find the funding to actually hire a taxi so she can go from place to place, and having to need a gun in her handbag just in case. So those are two different images.
Hope there and savoring new opportunity, but a long way from an easy road. We're talking tonight with Iraqi women about their lives and all that faces Iraq. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the women watching Iraq struggle toward an uncertain future? What role should women play in the rebuilding of Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Iraqi women in the studio with me about their lives and all that faces Iraq. You're welcome to join the conversation. Can you imagine being a woman in a country that 2 years from now could be a thriving secular democracy or could be a fundamentalist Islamic state? And can you imagine how the present insecurity in Iraq hits women hardest? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Ala Talabani, an Iraqi Kurd whose family has moved in and out of Iraq with the winds of change and danger there over a number of years. Lina Aboud, only 28 years old, only in the last few weeks, out of Iraq for the first time in her life, essentially out of Saddam Hussein's realm for the first time in her life in recent months. And Hind Makia, forced to leave Iraq in 1975, now based in the United Kingdom, co-founder of the Iraqi Women's Foundation. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Ala Talabani, I wonder if you'd help us understand this what appears to be a rather complex history of women's position in Iraq over the years. We read that in the 70s, in the 80s, Iraqi women had a position more free, more empowered than many women in the Muslim world, in the Middle East in any case, and that some of that power, that freedom, was ultimately lost in the 90s. How did that happen?
Iraqi women are very capable women if you compare it with the regional countries. We have thousands of women who they are doctors, engineers, officials, lecturers.
So clearly at some point a lot of freedom was offered to Iraqi women that's not widely available in the region.
Well, exactly, because it is of the society. Iraq is a very modern society, but all the hearts, all the emulated is being bring by the Iraqi regime, especially in the 90s, as you mentioned, after the first Gulf War, and the sanction as well played very bad role, the economic situation in Iraq. But for Iraqi women to go to high position, there was a condition for her. She was forced to join the Arab Baath Party. Mm-hmm. And then she would have a chance to be promoted, to be appointed to the high level. And yet we couldn't see any women in very high position in Iraq, as a minister, as a mayor, and in the leadership. Even in the Saddam Hussein regime's leadership committee, there were only one woman among 25, 26 men. So there wasn't an opportunity for Iraqi women to be in the political medium, actually.
And Hind Makia, my understanding is that the Baath Party originally promoted a kind of equality between the genders that in the 90s, after being pushed out of Kuwait in the Persian Gulf War, Saddam Hussein cranked up an effort to reach out to harder line Islamic leaders. That meant putting women back in kind of a box. We read here about the introduction of Article 111 to the Iraqi Penal Code, which, among other things, exempted men from prosecution if they killed female relatives who had quote unquote dishonored the family. This was part, I guess, of an effort to rally around him conservative forces within Iraqi society. Is that right? Is that when women lost ground?
It's the start of the process of women losing ground. it is fine to say women have opportunities in power and the secular, relative secular state was one where women had responsibilities and positions. But as Allah said, there were doctors. However, they didn't go to the highest level of government, participating at the highest level and influencing policy because they refused to join the Ba'ath Party in large numbers. So I would like to say that they were the quiet resistance, the soft resistance within Iraq. And the enforced Islamization period actually forced women back into their houses and back into domination by the mahram, which is basically the man responsible for the women. But it was a method of appeasing or putting down the symbols of resistance, because the headscarf had been a symbol of resistance by women. So it's a notion, if you wore a headscarf, it was a way of symbolizing your resistance.
Resistance to?
To Saddam. Mm-hmm. And so, in a sense, what he did is take away those tools or those symbols of resistance by actually engaging them and taking them on board under his terms and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So there was Islamization, but Islamization within the Ba'ath Party system and dictatorship and oppression.
Lena Aboud, yeah. as a young woman in Iraq during the years of Saddam Hussein's rule, did you hear older women talking about their latitude for action being reduced, their freedom being reduced? Did you feel this clamp down in the 1990s?
Yeah. Iraqis wasn't like weren't like that in 70s and the years before that, and they were practicing more freedom, and you can know that the first Arab minister, she was Iraqi in 1959. Dr. Naziha Dulaimi.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last, precisely the last 13 years from 1991 after war, there had been a great diminishing of the role of the women. And Saddam was encouraging to limited her role only for her house and taking care of her family and her husband and
mm-hmm.
children.
Mm-hmm. Go home, of course.
Yeah. And in another word, the embargo had been a great effect on this process, because, you know, the economical situation has been being worse through these years. And
under the UN embargo, led by the U.S.
So these two things just being a great effect on women to regret back and to go to her home instead to making more...
And really walking away from that higher bar of freedom that Iraqi women had known. And Ala Talabani, how about the moment now? Do you see a new opportunity for Iraqi women post-Saddam? Or do you share the concern that we've heard in some quarters that no one knows what this future is going to bring? It could end up even being a fundamentalist, conservative kind of future that would further reduce the scope of Iraqi women for action. How optimistic are you, or how concerned are you?
Well, despite all of the fear that there will be a fundamental country or an Islamic country, I have lots of hope inside me for Iraqi women, because I think this is the first time Iraqi women had this opportunity, this window of opportunity been opened for her to play her role in the society. In my point of view, Iraqi women been humiliated more than men. First, because they were subject to all Iraqi regime's crime. Secondly, because they are the other gender who they have to reap the aftermath of this crime. And let's not forget that it's a patriotic society which women still have a leak in their basic right. So that's why they are in, they like to share this democracy, the new life, this way, which is that all Iraq is passing through now, from dictatorship to democracy, to respecting human rights. in my point of view, without the participation of women, this is something imperfect. And this is, I noted from the my work the last few months in Iraq. Mm. I am in touch with Iraqi women nearly every day in the north, in the middle, in the south, even in the very religious area like Najaf. Mm-hmm. And they are in hope and they would like to participate in rebuilding the country. So NGOs, women's associations, started to be to appear and establish everywhere in Iraq for the first time. Mm. And who's doing this? It's the Iraqi women themselves. So that gave me hope of the future of Iraq.
That's great. Hin Makia, please.
One of my feelings as you're introducing that point is that there are many myths and legends sort of propagated to create fear and confusion, because at the moment there's a notion, will there be a fundamentalist state? That is seen as a negative thing. Will it be a secular state? That's seen as a positive thing. So where is Islam? So Islam seems to be seen as problematic.
Well, or at least if it's fundamentalist. Yeah. I mean, we all saw the brand of Islamic fundamentalism in Afghanistan. That didn't look fun for women.
No, and it isn't. And I'm not sort of giving an opinion on that. But what is at issue here is there's no opportunity to debate these issues and their impact on women's lives, because women are not involved in sufficient numbers, critical numbers, to influence the debate and the future, the constitution and the...
You mean right now, in spite of all the Talibani's optimism, you're saying where's the beef? Where's the actual level of participation that would work to guarantee women's place in the future Iraqi society?
And I'm optimistic as well, because if you have this image of a series of icebergs, you know, like Shackleton facing icebergs, the women can take these burdens and they can it's like think of a rocket going through beyond and flying off out of these obstacles. I have no doubt women are able to do that. They have the capacity. They've been organizing petitions. They've been organizing themselves as non-governmental organizations. They've been lobbying. But their voice has been ignored. It's been ignored by all parties involved in Iraq. And my sort of call really is that the participation of women is something that will benefit the future democracy of Iraq. The women are over 50% of the population. How can you have a preparation of constitution committee where there are no women?
And that's the current situation.
That's the current situation. Yeah. And so there's a sense of urgency in terms of having women's representation in a significant numbers that reflect them. So the critical numbers are 30%, 40%.
That doesn't seem to bode terribly well.
That's why Iraqi women's made recommendation in the three conferences, large conferences, what they held in Baghdad and Babylon and in the north. They come with recommendation that they don't want to see less than 40% women participating in the drafting of the constitution.
But right now there's not a single woman on this early body that's been put together
exactly,
to move towards that.
Exactly. In the committee for the constitution, which has been established by the governing council, there's no one woman among them.
So heads up, it doesn't look real good. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to invite them in if you'd be good enough. Aaron's calling from Medway, Massachusetts. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
My question was regarding, obviously, the fall of Saddam and the reestablishment, hopefully, of democracy in Iraq. I was curious, the issue of women's rights and their role in this seemed to be equally as important. I would like to get the women's from Iraq, that your point of view as to whether or not you feel there can be any outside help, say, from the Americans or other agencies, to help make the women's awareness in Iraq more prevalent and to make that stand?
It's a good question, Aaron. Thanks very much, especially in as much as more than 100,000 Americans are right there in the country. Is there something that can be done by outsiders, by Americans? Lina Abud.
Yeah, first I want to thank you for your feelings, for your nice feelings. There's a lot of things to be done to support Iraqi women. First, to support the NGOs, organizations, by everything, to sharing experiences or funding or anything you can do. And to use those who are policy makers to make them as a point of pressure to get women's rights right in the moment in Iraq, especially as my colleagues mentioned, in constitution and the next coming new Iraqi government.
But do you feel like the American-led provisional authority in Iraq is standing up for the rights of women, for the position of women in Iraqi society, Lina Abood?
Yes, they've been so helpful for Iraqi women.
And yet on this constitutional committee, we don't see women.
Can I beg to differ on that?
Yeah.
I think there are words, but I don't see the actions. So for me, if the outcomes aren't there, my feeling is the words are empty. And I feel passionately about that. But I do think there are, to answer your questioner's question, there are things you can do and the U.S. government or the U.S. citizens can do, and that's is support our lobbying and our petitions for our voice to be heard at all levels, because we're doing the work in Iraq and we need the support from the outside, the West and the Arab world.
So more than words, but real action. Yeah. Let's take another call. I see Swanee, it must be Swanee Hunt calling here, former ambassador. Hello and welcome, Swanee Hunt. Thanks for your call.
Thanks. It's good to speak with you.
It's good to have you. Now, you're involved, actually, with the group that's brought these three women to town, Women Waging Peace. What's that about, Swanee Hunt?
Women Waging Peace is a network of women, about 250 women from 30 different conflicts, and we bring them together with policymakers, with people from the State Department, the UN, World Bank, major NGOs, the EU, et cetera, Pentagon. And we help the policymakers understand the work of women like Ala Enhant and Lena and Sussman as untapped resources, because if we had all that we needed to avert or stop wars, we wouldn't have all the conflicts we've got. But in fact, we don't know what's going on the ground, and that's why we need women like them to be plugged into anything we're doing in the security world.
But Swanee Hunt, they're saying, hey, we need help here. We've got the right words from the U.S. administration, but we don't necessarily have the right support to give women the backing they need to really be at the heart of what's going on.
They're absolutely right. I was at the Pentagon in June, and I had just put together a conference with 26 Iraqi women in Washington, all of whom said they were very anxious to play leadership roles. And at the Pentagon, I was with the person who was the point person on the Washington side for the provisional authority that you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of an hour-long conversation, he allowed us how maybe it was important to think about what was going on with the women in Iraq. But he started out the conversation saying, you know, we have a lot of security concerns, and once we get the place secure, then we can start thinking about the women.
It's easy to imagine how that would overshadow everything else. Swanee Hunt, thanks very much for your call. And here we are. We can diminish those security concerns. On the other hand, we know they're very real. Lina Abood, as I understand it, you live with your parents in Baghdad,
yeah,
and between the airport and the main city.
Yeah.
And it was not long ago that there were resistance fighters of some kind on your rooftop to shoot at U.S. soldiers. Soldiers fired back. A missile hit your home.
Yeah.
Well, that's not
right.
Very convenient.
Yes, because, you know, there are so many of those called themselves the sacrifices, the Arab sacrifices, that they are related to Al-Qaeda and some sorts of these Arab sacrifices. And they were in those areas to be in front of the American troops to and the coalition troops.
Did your parents know that they were on your rooftop, or did they climb up through your living room and through the rooms of your hospital?
Yeah. My father was there, and he was knowing what's going on.
And did he try to stop them? Was he afraid to try and stop
them? No, we cannot get out. You know, it's too risky. There's bundles of fire and shooting on you. Yeah.
And so was your house seriously damaged by the return fire?
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is not an easy situation in which to live. We've got to hear more stories from you. We're so glad you're here tonight. We're talking with Iraqi women about their lives and all that faces Iraq. In Lina Abood's case, that has included recently a missile in the top of her house. You can join the conversation. When there's no burqa to throw off, what's the mark of liberation? And what do you need to hear from these three Iraqi women? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Asprey. I'm Tom Asprey. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Iraqi women about their lives and all that faces Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Are women's issues first-order concerns for Iraq, or should they wait for security and stability? And what's your question for the women watching Iraq struggle toward an uncertain future? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight in the studio, Ala Talabani, Lena Aboud, and Hind Makia. Duncan's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Duncan. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Good evening.
I'm not too familiar with the culture in Iraqi society, but I think that Iraqi women maybe have more rights than other Muslim cultures, but maybe not as much as the women here in the United States. But
that seems to sum it up pretty well. At least they have had more rights, yeah?
Yeah. And so I think that this whole issue in Iraq, the Iraqi women are kind of having to take maybe like a back seat to some of the actions that maybe provoked the United States to do these things, and it was maybe not fully... Or maybe they didn't have any part in this, in these actions at all.
So you're saying they're paying the price for the shenanigans of men?
Really, yes.
Is that your point, Duncan?
Yes, that is my point.
And I wonder how they feel about that. Duncan, thanks for your call. Hind Makia.
I like that approach. But the thing is, we are part of the solution. And I think if you say, do we wait for security before someone deals with our issues, or as many Iraqi men have told me, and expatriates mostly really, is we know what you need because we've been in the West, we know what women's rights are. Let's sort out housing, electricity, security, and then we'll deal with equality. My issue is the U.S. and the Iraqi Governing Council and the security are missing an opportunity to use a valuable resource, which is over 50% of the population, which are the women, in terms of establishing security, because we know best about the security. We can negotiate.
You mean you want to put police women on the streets?
No, I'm saying let's use the women in the community, the neighborhoods, the districts, to help the giving up of arms and the securing of street by street. If it's done to Iraqis and sort of with soldiers going in, even if they're Iraqi soldiers, into homes which have women and children, then there's a miscommunication there. There's
you mean
a
if it's
fear.
American soldiers coming
and
in?
Even Iraqi soldiers, mm-hmm. because they're scared. Mm-hmm. But if the women are involved in negotiating with the community, because we are good negotiators, that's what we do all our lives, is negotiate and moderate. We can improve. We can assist security forces, be they American or Iraqi, in establishing a more secure environment.
But is that realistic, Kanan Makia? Hind Makia. Of course, your brother is Kanan Makia, very well known as a scholar and exile who pushed hard for America to get involved in this ouster of Saddam Hussein and all that's followed. But as I understand it, after you having been there for several months, you have now left Iraq in part because it's too dangerous for you to stay there. How are you going to go street by street building security if you can't even have the safety to be in the country?
Don't ask me the question about me personally, because it's the women of Iraq, and I'm one of them.
Why does it not include you personally? Then?
It doesn't include me personally because basically I
have
no home.
Your family story is different.
My family story is different in the sense I have no home to go back to. So I've got a member of the family I can stay with. They are very elderly, so mm-hmm. there's personal reasons why I would be a burden
okay.
on her. So there are personal reasons mm-hmm. in that sense. But the women of Baghdad and want to be involved in securing their neighborhoods. And they have proposed the mechanisms to the CPA and to Baghdad Council as to how their involvement in securing the peace can enhance and speed up the process. So the thing is, there is an untapped resource. Mm. And we're not going in to take the guns out. We're going in to negotiate. It's, if you call it a soft security. It's a negotiation skills. And we have those skills. So I can look someone eye to eye and engage in a process rather than forcing my way into someone's home and increasing the fear. So that's the untapped resource.
Ala Talabani, is that a realistic approach in your mind? In 1997, as I understand it, your home was demolished by a tank. It is hard to negotiate with a tank. Are we in a different era now? Would it be possible for Iraq's women to soften the whole process of adjustment in that country?
That was 1997 when we have to negotiate with a dictatorship. He was Saddam Hussein. It's a different period now. Mm-hmm. We are going through different times. It is the time, as I said, that Iraq is all going through new life, new political life. And that's why I think negotiation is easier than the before, because at least if we are going to have, well, women's negotiation will be with the governing council, mm-hmm. with the CPA, and we've done it. As my friends here said earlier, we lobbied them. There was lots of campaign. We did lots of recommendation, and we are meeting them nearly daily basis.
But you had only one female member, as I recall, of the governing council who was assassinated. Is that not right?
Well, there were three of them, and one of them, Aqila, unfortunately, she assassinated. And there's one women ministry among 24. We know that. We've been disappointed. And that's why we are trying hardly to push the political participation of women in Iraq.
Let me ask you about a broader question at this table. I know, Ala Talabani, you're Kurdish.
Yes.
Lina Abud, Sunni, Muslim.
No, Shia.
Shia, I'm sorry. Yeah. And Hind Makia, I don't even know.
Does it matter?
Well, it only matters in this way, that we know that there are important, long-standing, and sometimes violent divisions within Iraqi society. And I'd just like to get your view on where that's headed. There's fear expressed outside Iraq that we could end up with a kind of civil war there if things don't go well. Lina Abud,
yeah.
What's your view?
I think my point of view, and I'm as, you know, I've been in Iraq for the entire of my life, there is no bigger problem between Sunni and Shia. Until now.
Until now, there's not a problem.
No problem, yeah. But there's some problem between the Shia themselves, and they're created by some, you know, extremist persons that's being encouraged from directions out, from outside Iraq. Maybe, you know, the neighboring countries.
Right, you say no problem, but right now there's a heavy Sunni resistance to the Coalition Provisional Authority and the post-Saddam set up, we're told, because they're afraid that they will lose privileges that they had for many years under
That's
Saddam.
Right. Maybe against the CPA, as you are mentioned. Mm-hmm. But between the Iraqis themselves, I don't think so.
Ala Talabani, as a Kurd, what do you think?
Can I tell you an example?
Please.
The last women conference was in Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 250 women gathered from all over Iraq. There were women from Basra, from Najaf, from Karbala, from Babylon, from Mosul, from Kirkuk, and from Kurdistan, from Baghdad as well. We discussed through 2 days lots of issues. We come to the very hard and tough issue, but we agreed in the points of women's need, that we all need the full participation of Iraqi women in reconstruction in the country. And in the last part of the conference, we had a party, all Iraqi women, Kurd, Shia, there were Turkmen and Assyrian as well. We hold hand and we danced and we said we are the peace builder.
Regardless of ethnicity, regardless of religious affiliation.
Exactly. Yes.
Hind Makia, what's your sense of how the post-Saddam period's going so far? Are you optimistic, not just about women's role, but about the whole picture there? Americans are looking on with great apprehension. Is it going well?
I'm fearful because I think there are mixed, there's positive things, and I think Baghdad City Council is an example of a very positive developments in the budding sort of forms of democracy. And so that, in one respect, I'm positive and sort of looking forward to the future. But I'm also fearful. Fearful in a sense of the discussions that divide, create divisions. The differences between the Sunnis and the Shiites, and the difference between the Shiites themselves, and the fact that the independent people or people of different political parties in the governing council is representative of this different variety in independence, is a great opportunity a great improvement from one person deciding for all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part, if we try to understand that these differences are part of a political dialogue that we're engaging in, then we can see a way forward. But if we see the differences as part of what could be a civil war, an upending civil war, then they become ways of dividing us. So that's why I didn't answer your question, in the sense it didn't matter what I was. Iraq is a melting pot of ethnicity, multicultural.
And yet not fully melted. We hope that you all will help with that. And we're very grateful to each of you for being with us tonight. Hind Makia, Lina Aboud, Ala Talabani, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Senator John McCain speaks out on troop deployment in Iraq. This is On Point. One of the Senate's strongest supporters of the war in Iraq is lashing out against the Bush administration's handling of the war's aftermath. Republican Senator John McCain told the Council on Foreign Relations yesterday that there is an insufficient number of troops for the job in Iraq. But he also criticized those who are calling Iraq another Vietnam. Iraq is not Vietnam, McCain said. But if we are to avoid a debate over who lost Iraq, as we debated who lost Vietnam a generation ago, we must act urgently to transform our military success into a lasting political victory. Here is more of John McCain's speech.
Iraq is not Vietnam. There is no popular, widespread anti-colonial insurgency in Iraq. There are killers who prospered under the tyranny of Saddam and seek its restoration. Unlike in Vietnam, the Iraqi Baathists and terrorists who oppose us are not gorilla fish swimming in a friendly sea of the people. Our opponents, who number only in the thousands in a country of 23 million, are despised by the vast majority of Iraqis. The vast majority of Iraqis share our goal of defeating the remnants of Saddam's regime and their terrorist allies. Unlike in Vietnam, the Iraqi insurgents do not enjoy the kind of sanctuary North Korea, Cambodia, and Laos provided. They do not have a superpower patron that sponsors supplies and sustains them beyond the reach of our power for geopolitical reasons. These murderers cannot carry the banner of Iraqi nationalism as did Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam for decades. Most fundamentally, Iraq is not Vietnam because the United States and the Iraqi people share the same goal of building a free, prosperous, and secure Iraq. Our defeat in Vietnam, nonetheless, holds cautionary lessons. We lost in Vietnam because we lost the will to fight, because we did not understand the nature of the war we were fighting, and because we limited the tools at our disposal. Tet in 1968 was a massive battlefield defeat for the North, but a strategic defeat for the United States, because the American press and the American public saw our leaders talk about a light at the end of the tunnel that did not exist. We can win the war in Iraq, but not if we lose the popular support in the United States of America. The United States will fail in Iraq if our adversaries believe they can outlast us. If our troop deployment schedules are more important than our staying power, we embolden our enemies and make it harder for our friends to take risks on our behalf. When the United States announces a schedule for training and deploying Iraqi security officers, then announces the acceleration of that schedule, then accelerates it again, it sends a signal of desperation, not certitude. When in the course of days we increase by thousands our estimates of the numbers of Iraqis trained, it sounds like somebody is cooking the books. When we do this as our forces are coming under increasing attack, we suggest to friends and allies alike that our ultimate goal in Iraq is leaving as soon as possible, not meeting our strategic objective of building a free and democratic country in the heart of the Arab world. Our overall troop level in Iraq does not reflect a careful assessment of what it takes to achieve victory. It reflects the number of American forces who were in Iraq when the war ended, minus the Marines who were sent home. Simply put, there does not appear to be a strategy behind our current force levels in Iraq other than to preserve the illusion that we have sufficient forces in place to meet our objectives. It makes even less sense to defend a troop ceiling that has been in place since April, as American forces and our Iraqi allies have come under increasingly savage attack.
Republican Senator John McCain speaking yesterday to the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.